Hello, everybody, and welcome to actually the first episode of what it's going to be called Mooney's Mini Bites. I'm your host, Cozy, and I'm going to always buy Wani B here. And this is our first Mooney's Mini Bites episode. Juan, this is uncharted territory we're in, bro.
So to take the listeners through it, basically the concept is to do more focused, roughly around 30-minute episodes, either weekly reviews of the big shows out right now, maybe sometimes sports talk, maybe just, you know, little ideas that aren't fully deserving of their own episode, but we want to just get out and focus to you guys. So for the first episode today, we're going to discuss one of the hottest shows out right now. We're going to review the first two episodes.
Silo?
Oh, almost.
Not Silo?
Almost. Silo is one of my favorites too, but I think Severance is a good bit higher.
No. We're here for Severance, and you're actually here to convince me because I am the ultimate skip bitch, and I have not watched a lot of Severance.
Kelsey has not watched one this. This is the best damn TV show on TV, so the goal here is to...
I have seen it.
Yes.
No, I'm sorry, go on.
So the goal is to both review the episode and hopefully convince Kosi's bitch ass to start watching.
Yeah, I've seen the first four episodes of season one, and then I was like, oh, this is a great show. Let me come back to this, and then just life and just other stuff got in the way. So yeah, from what I've seen, it's been great. But yeah, man, convince me and the viewers, Juan, as to why we should watch Severance.
Okay. Since it has been 3 full years since the release of season one, we'll give a kind of quick recap and then go basically the format of the episode. We'll go with the plot of the episodes we're reviewing. In this case, we'll discuss the themes, favorite things we liked and didn't like. And then for Severance and other kind of mystery box shows in particular, we'll try to take a look at where the show is going, trying to make some predictions about where it could, some of the things could lead, where some of the clues could be looking at, just try to predict some of the future of what we see on the show.
Yes, and viewers, when Juan says like stuff like mystery box, like the most famous mystery box show ever is Lost, and it's a show that has a lot of these open-ended questions, like a lot of these like theories you might have, but like it kind of leads you along a lot as the show goes on. So Severance is one of those. So I am curious to see just where, you know, you think things are heading with this show, because just from the trailers, it's a crazy concept. I know the concept vaguely, but just looking at like the new trailers for this new season, it looked like they're kind of going in a crazy new direction, and it looks very, very interesting.
It's a very stylized show. So basically the concept, and going back to season one, the Severance, the titular Severance, is a procedure which basically splits the memories of the people who get it. They get a brain chip implanted to them. And basically when they go to a special floor on that building at work, their minds are not white, entirely blank. They still remember how to do things. They can tell you what a fish is. They can tell you what America is, what different foods are. But they don't remember any individual specific details of their lives, right? So they could tell you that America is a country, but they couldn't tell you what city they live in. They don't know their real names. They don't know if they have families, children.
They're the perfect corporate drone, basically.
Basically, especially if you wanted to do highly confidential stuff, right? Like a spy who couldn't remember what he had looked at, you know, in theory would be the perfect spy, right? In fact, I think that's kind of where the show is going to go a little bit. But right now, basically, at the beginning of season one, we get introduced to the concept through the character called Helly R. She's played by Britt Lower.
Britt Lower, yeah.
I haven't actually seen her in too many other things, but she does a great performance. Basically, we're introduced to her at the point where she's just been severed and gotten employed at the company called Lumen. The Lumen is the main company that kind of controls this. It's a big behemoth. It's supposed to make you think of companies like Purdue Pharma or Apple. It's kind of a combination of things. It's supposed to be kind of a biochem company. And obviously they're implanting people's brains, so they have quite a bit of medical expertise.
It felt almost like a mixture between Apple and like one of those like crazy startups like WeWork. So it's kind of reminding me of those, like a
design-wise, especially the severance floor. That's how it is. The rest of the Lumen office is actually kind of a bit of brutalist architecture, a lot of concrete pillars and open space.
Yeah, real harsh.
Like, you know, a lot of sharp angles and such. The severance floor again, just think an Apple store on steroids. Just pure gleaming white panels everywhere. Super manicured carpets and everything. It feels
like a doctor's office almost.
Yeah, or like an extreme dentist office. It looks like the kind of place aliens would take you when they're doing an anal probe. You know, when they take you out of outer space. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's a crazy.
Like the lighting. Yeah.
It adds to the atmosphere of the show, certainly, that they're working there. So again, the concept is that when you're in there, you have no memory. And so Helly, this main girl, she freaks out, gets pissed off, starts getting violent because, you know, she feels like she's trapped. She doesn't remember anything. She reacts
Is Helly?
Just trying to remember. That's a Britt Lower.
Britt Lower.
It's a she. Yeah, it's a she.
And Adam Scott.
And Adam Scott.
She and Adam Scott, they're...
Adam Scott is basically her boss. He actually gets promoted episode one to the manager because his best buddy and the previous manager disappears. Apparently fired. Again, they don't really know anything. They don't know anything about what goes on in the outside world and their outside versions. Their inside versions by the show are called Innies, and their outside versions are called Outies, which does sound childless, and they're kind of childish, and there's a purpose to that, which I'll go into. But so basically they're Outies, they're normal outside versions, know nothing of what's going on inside, and they're, you know, from their perspective, they get in an elevator to go down, and then next thing they know, they're coming back up the elevator to go home. You know, 8 hours have passed, zero perception of time. It's not like they've been sleeping or anything. They just have zero perception of time while that's happening, right? So it's just 8 hours where you're...
And like to...
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, and just to piggyback off of that, just from... They do a good job, Ben Stiller, the director, and also Dan Everson. They do a good job of, like, really conveying that, again, in the first season, of just that feeling of slogging to work. Oh, man, let me punch in, let me slog right back, and then go to bed, then come right back and do it all over again. This whole, like, monotonous, it's like clockwork almost. And, like, they do a good job of, like, conveying that in this show, just the feeling and the vibes. I like to say vibes a lot, but like they definitely did that. So like when hearing you say that, I was like, yeah, they definitely make you feel as though like as soon as you get past those doors, like you're in that world. Like, yeah, you're an outie out there, yeah, but when as soon as you're in and you're an innie, like you're really in, and like you're like in this world. I think they do a good job of conveying that to the viewer.
You know, I love that you say that, Cosi, because that's a big part of the theme in the show. Really, in a way, the show can be described as a bizarro sci-fi version of Office Space. That's Mike Judge,
fantastic.
That's the Mike Judge movie from back in the early 2000s.
Stigler.
There's a lot of similarities between, especially the inside corporate innie culture, where they're inside working. Vibe-wise, thematically, there's a lot of similarities to the monotony, disenchantment, frustration felt by the main characters in Office Space, right? There's a little bit of a comedy, too. It's not meant to be laugh-out-loud funny very often, more kind of quirky. It really wants to get into the existential horror of the corporate drone life and the existential implications of this kind of technology, where you become kind of this perfect, flawless worker, but that's their innie versions. Really, you know, they don't feel like they're their outie versions, right? They feel like their own selves. They even have kind of their own personality almost, and their own little interests and stuff. And they have no life. Their entire existence is, you know, they appear from an elevator at work, fully dressed in a suit or whatever. Almost all of them wear a suit or some kind of really professional corporate clothing. They sit down at their desk where they do this mysterious job. They don't really understand that they're just told is important, right? And it seems kind of senseless. They're just kind of like rounding up numbers on a computer screen is their main job of the people we follow the most, the macro data refinement department. And that's where Adam Scott and Britt Lowers and all them work. And it really captures the essence of this kind of, you know, they're little prizes for performing well when they're in there. They give them an eraser, like a pencil eraser, a little like Chinese finger traps, waffle parties. Actually, the waffle party is more interesting than you'd think from the sound of it. But like melon like parties, like the kind of stupid little corporate perks, you know, like when you get a little coffee mug from your company and they tell you good job or some dumb little plaque instead of actually paying you or, you know, making you feel fulfilled in any way. It really tries to become a like a very stylized parody of that, right? Like a satire of that office culture, of the way, you know, like these innies are, get really excited to, you know, receive little finger traps and, you know, little perks and rewards, because that's all they know. They're essentially children in a lot of ways. That's what I was talking about when they call them innies and outies. They're treated like children. Go ahead, Cozy.
Yeah, and just to and just to reiterate that too, just going back to the performances, like again, like I think the whole face of the franchise I'd say is Adam Scott. Adam Scott, I knew him from like, you know, from Parks and Rec and other stuff like that, and like, you know, he's known as a comedic actor, but you know, even watching him Parks and Rec, which I know him a lot from. He definitely has a dramatic side, and I think he, just watching him again in the four episodes I've seen him in, he really embodies that idea of a guy who, I don't know if he, like, of a guy who's laser focused on this. He's committed to the company, but definitely is beginning to see some cracks in what's happening in the reality. And I think that's awesome. I think it's an awesome angle to go in. And it's awesome that we got somebody like Adam Scott, because again, this is something where, like, you know, I didn't expect this out of him, and I just loved seeing him, you know, kind of stretch this other muscle. And again, you mentioned Britt Lower, but just the whole cast, like John Turturro's in this, yes. Christopher Walken's in this, but a guy in particular that, sure, again, sure, I was shocked was in this show is Zach Cherry. Zach Cherry, a lot of the viewers might not know the name, but you've seen him. He's Zach Cherry. If you saw Spider-Man Homecoming, there's some guy with a high-pitched voice saying, "Hey, Spider-Man, do a flip, Spider-Man!" Yeah, that guy.
He was in Fallout.
So he's in the show.
He was in Fallout.
Yeah, he's also in Fallout. He's in Shang-Chi. So, like, I love how Ben Stiller and them were able to assemble this cast of people you just wouldn't expect,
you know, big
to be in
these situations. You haven't named yet. Mel Tillman. He plays Mr.
Oh, yes.
Mr.
Yes,
Milkshake. Most people on the internet call him Mr. Milkshake. He's basically their direct supervisor. And he's one of the few non-severed people, like, you know, basically real people that are working down there, along with Patricia Arquette as Miss Cobell. And it's,
oh wow,
he does an incredible job of doing this kind of fake polite corporate smile and corporate like do good or happy kind of HR attitude mixed with an incredible, incredible menace behind it. Right. He has an incredible ability to smile, this legitimate smile that tells the characters, you know, don't fuck up or else I'll stop smiling.
Yeah, it's like, hey, man, get it done. Hey, man, get it done or I'll kill you.
Yeah.
You know, he's not like, kidding.
Hey, didn't they say something along the lines of that in the first season where it's like, no, you want to see him nice and smiling because you really don't want to see him when he stops. You really don't want to see when that smile drops, right? So, again, it's very early on implicated that they're being abused, basically. And it's shown. It's shown in season one.
And I think that also speaks to, again, corporate, like, they, when they love you, they love you, they'll bring you in, but when they lay the hammer down and have to get rid of you or, you know, anything like that, they waste no time showing you that side as well. Again, like, they do a lot of, like, conveying and showing in this show, like, through characters and writing and dialogue and whatnot, and I just, again, I appreciate this show for that. So, yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, so, great. Continuing on to some of the recap, basically, we get insight into the inner workings of the company. We find out the Lumen is owned, and basically, especially on the innie floor, but even on the outside, they essentially worship the founder of the company, a man named Keir Egan. All the CEOs and all the important people have been his family members. They have actual like wax statues and a whole floor dedicated to like the Egan name and history. And you know, he's presented as
a cult, basically.
Yeah, he's presented as a borderline
a cult leader,
Jesus-like figure. Even within his own family, the still existing members, at one point they call him not grandfather, but the grandfather. You know, they when he's shown in videos and stuff, he's often literally flying through the sky, kind of encouraging Jesus-like figure multiple times. It's just revered to an incredible extent.
Right. So they're even like they're reinforcing like the fact to their employees, like, hey, this guy is God essentially. And like,
John Turturro's character and Christopher Walken, that's actually how they bond, because they actually kind of fully buy into it. And so that's their purpose. They don't care about the little perks and stuff. It's like, oh, we're here to serve Keir. We're here to serve Lumen. This is like the glorious purpose for which we have, you know, which we, again, all they do is work. They don't actually have a clock out period where they nap or anything. At the end of the day, they finish at their desk. They clock out. They go into an elevator. And the literal next instant, they're just coming back down the elevator to work. Right? If they have a sick day or something, they don't. They just, you know, they don't have a sick day. They don't feel it. They just realize the day after that it didn't come into work the next day. Right? They have no knowledge of
why. They have a personal life.
They have zero personal life. They have zero anything. Okay. They're being watched constantly. They're treated entirely as children, right? It's impossible to escape. That's why their names, all their names, they kind of like, instead, like Heli R's name is supposed to be Helena. They don't give them their last name. Like Adam Scott's character is called Mark S. Zach Cherry's character is called Dylan G, right? John Turturro's character is called Irv B. Like, it's kind of like these kind of, you know, the kind of nicknames you'd see, like kind of
like an elementary school. Like if you write on, like you write on like your name tag, like you don't want to, kids can write their full last name. Do they write like their first name and whatever the first letter of the last
name
is.
The bosses, the ones who aren't severed, it's Mr. Milchick and Ms. Cobell, right? They got proper names, kind of like a teacher would, right? Like, imagine the last like school, time you actually called your boss. You know, it might be your boss or something, but usually, you know, it's a professional environment. You're going to call him by first name once you get
it. It's Mr.
Sir, obviously, and stuff, but not in this way where you're a child, right? You're just kind of childlike, ignorant figure. You have no idea what's going on. You're being given basically little useless toys. I mean, the pencil erasers they get, they don't even have pencils. Like, they go out of their way to show you how silly this is, right? They don't even.
Well, it sounds like it's meant to just like keep them sedated, or like keep them like in that state, really.
Exactly.
That's what it sounds like.
And, you know, they have other things, like they have a break room. Okay. A corporate break room usually means, oh, hey, nice spot for a break. You can go relax. Here, the meaning is more like the room where they break you. It's basically a situation where you have to go into this dark room with a bright light shining in your face and literally for hours just repeat, like, you know, some long I'm sorry phrase where it's like, I'm sorry, sorry is all that I am and all that I can be, all I can, like some cult kind of shit where like, oh, hey, you fucked up. And then the Mr. Milchick just says repeatedly, I'm afraid you didn't mean it. And you know, they'll say it hundreds of times, right? For hours and hours at a time.
Yeah,
they have a,
it's a literal break room.
They have a wellness room that's kind of almost seems like a parody of, you know, like massage parlors with the nice music and the soothing little trees and stuff and the bonsai trees. And they have a character there who tells them like nice things about their Audi, supposedly. Like they tell them, oh, your Audi is a generous person who is liked by all. But if you have one particular fact or one particular thing you react to more or are happier about, you get punished. She says, oh, you lost 10 points. If you lose 100 points, the session will be over. Like, you know, like, so now they're nervous and they don't want to react and they're scared. It's all, even the things that are supposedly meant to be rewards are kind of meant to scare them into compliance, scare them into.
Yeah, it's meant to control. Yeah.
Again, it's all a bizarro satire of actual corporate stuff, right? The corporate people will have a wellness room where they can go in there, supposedly listen to music and relax. But, you know, if you're stressed out and tortured and stuff at your job, going into some small, you know, pretty room with lights isn't going to make you feel all that much better, right? It's like a bandage for the way they're treating you overall, right? It's meant to parody the way corporate culture, you know, gives you these little perks and these little things to keep you happy and kind of keep you in compliance, keep you not asking too many questions. So yeah,
it kind of sounds like how the way corporate people would almost like kind of wish they could treat employees, or how they wish the employees would act. Like, exactly. You know, everybody wants someone that can follow orders. Nobody really wants someone that can, like, you know, think for themselves or think, because, you know, the corporation has done all the thinking for you. You just go and execute.
Exactly.
So, like, I understand. It's kind of crazy how, like, it's very topical too, especially now today, like how corporations are, and people are kind of getting fed up with how
also corporations are run. So the way a lot of work today feels meaningless and empty, like you're just moving numbers around in a spreadsheet or doing stuff,
going through the motions,
but that doesn't really add any actual value to the world. You know, you're just, I don't know, you're just moving numbers so that other people can make more money, but it doesn't seem to add any actual benefit to anybody but the people making money. It's not engaging.
You know what's kind of like,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
You know what I kind of find inherently kind of like off-putting about Mr. Milkshake? It's like he said he's neither an innie or an out. He's just the guy who just hasn't been severed, right?
Yes, correct. So he has his memories.
Yeah, like, yeah, so, right. So, like, again, the corporate's able to, like, employ people who can, you know, follow the orders and enforce them. You know, this guy has the luxury of being able to, I'm guessing, go home to his life, but he's able to come back and enforce that and be, and be like, I'm sorry, what did you say?
No, that's exactly right. You're exactly correct. They actually, yeah.
It's kind of scary.
Point of conflict in the show where they actually attack him multiple times because he's kind of toying with them. They get kind of glimpses of the horrors. Like, for instance, at one point, John Turturro and Christopher Walken kind of establish a gay relationship. They kind of fall in love with each other, which they're not supposed to do, but over the course of the season, they do that. And then at the end, where they find out they're kind of teaming up with the different departments, because they're not supposed to team up. They're not even supposed to know where each other department are. So you only...
Oh, they keep it compartmentalized.
Yeah. So these people only see four people, four other people every day, and then the boss. That's pretty much their entire world, right? At one point, they see like eight people at once, and they see, wow, I've never seen so many people at once. And it's literally true. That person inside has never seen even eight people at the same time. Scarcely ever more than four. So, yeah. So Christopher Walken, they kind of get in trouble for kind of starting to unite a little bit and trying to find out what's going on. And then Christopher Walken suddenly comes in and says, oh, I'm retiring. My Audi is, you know, no longer going to work at Lumen. He's getting older, so he's retiring. And though, so, you know, they try to play it as this nice thing, like the way you'd have a normal corporate retirement party with cake and music and all that stuff. And then John Turturro comes in and says, you're literally killing him. Why are you cheering that this man we all love is going to die tomorrow? We were never going to see him again. He's not going to exist anymore. So there's that horrifying implication there, too, where if you fuck up too much, you get fired. And like your Audi gets fired, which to them is just losing a job, obviously. But to you, you no longer exist. Literally. If you don't,
and you know what's you know what's crazy about that?
Go ahead.
Like, oh wait, so if what's crazy about that is like I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but they've kind of convinced them, like, hey, if you die in this Matrix like setting, you die in the real world. I think it's kind of crazy how they've been able to like convince them and basically essentially brainwash them into believing, like, hey,
they know
what
for a fact. They know for a fact if their Audi simply decides not to come in, if their Audi the next day simply decides to quit work, they no longer exist. Right? They only exist while they're in the severance floor. Right? They only exist while they're down there. That's the only place where
does Mark S. know who he is outside?
No. Very interesting part. Really get taken into the live of is Mark Scout. That's his name outside. That's Adam Scott's character. His entire reason for being severed, for severing himself, for being employed and going there, is because his wife died in a car accident, and he just had such a poor time dealing with the grief that he decided that severing his mind and not having to think about his wife, just basically not existing for 8 hours, was preferable to suffering those 8 hours thinking about his wife. That's his character's motivation for going to work.
It's kind of like the men that, like, when they lose a spouse or women who lose their spouse, they throw themselves into their work and kind of neglect everything. Exactly. They essentially are kind of dead to everybody.
Again, it's very topical, very the way they go into real life issues. It's a sci-fi, you know, very stylized, often over the top, kind of silly and stuff. But it all has a purpose. It's all meant to be a funhouse mirror reflection of real life corporate abuses and problems. So we find out about his family, that he's depressed, that he's still terrible. His family's kind of worried about him, that he did the severance procedure. And it feels like a lot of people are like, you know, find that horrifying that somebody would do that to themselves. It's not like a widely accepted thing. It's like recently become a more popular thing. So, you know,
was it controversial in their universe? Was it like a controversial thing where they had to, like,
actually part of the plot of the point, at some point they show a powerful senator who became a powerful senator in part because he supported the severance program for Lumen. It's very obviously implied.
Okay,
they paid.
Okay, it's a campaign strategy.
They paid for him, you know, like the kind of in the real world politicians sell out. It's very much meant to be a direct implication. And part of what he gets, which is a very trippy concept, the severance chip, it turns out, does not only work in the Lumen base floor. Basically, his wife gets severed so she can get pregnant, have a baby, and just not experience those 9 months. Like, in her mind, she basically went into hibernation for 9 months to have the baby. And then just came out, you know, fully baby in her arms, like, oh, ready to go. Right. So her.
And you hear about a lot of these like hardworking corporate women that, you know, they get pregnant, and unfortunately, and they have to take that leave. And
she's a senator's
you
know, they wife, see the, so they it's see the like, mature. Obviously, it's not quite the same thing. But.
Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, she's meant to represent the rich and powerful, taking advantage of the severance chip for their own leisure. Right, not meant to represent you know, some kind of other abuse. Like, she chooses to do that, right?
I also kind of see the parallel again to like successful women in workspaces that, you know, become mothers and have to leave for maternity leave. Some of them, you know, some of them view the kid as almost like a detachment from furthering their career. And they have to take the leave and all that. So I can definitely see the parallels even in that. Like, what if you could just, you know, wipe out?
I kind of see where you're coming from, but where it doesn't work is that a woman who did that, a professional woman, would probably be working during pregnancy and probably wouldn't be able to take all that time off if she wanted to keep her high-powered career. Whereas with this, is very much implied that it's basically set to be a horror show for the innie. Like, this... one of the Mark's sister base is pregnant and meets this woman at a kind of a pregnancy kind of birthing retreat. And basically they bond and she tells him, oh, look, I'm so excited to have my baby and I'm pregnant. And the next time she sees this woman, she has no memory. She's named the baby a completely different thing. Basically, this any woman got to have the whole experience of like loving her baby, feeling it kick inside her belly, all that, and then was wiped from existence. Right, it was meant to be a heart, like show the horrors of what rich, powerful people will do. In this case, in theory, to themselves, right, like a kind of version of themselves. But as long as they don't have to see or experience it, they don't care about that suffering.
Yeah, they see something even like as beautiful as childbirth as like something they can like bypass and like
exactly
and like and have like a workaround for because if you have enough money, there is nothing you can bypass or work around. That's really, you're right, it's a horror show.
Yeah, it's a horror show. So look, at this point, we also find out that Ms. Cobell, Mark's boss and the sever floor lead within the company, is actually also his next door neighbor who's going by Miss Selvig and is pretending to be a lactation expert. So she literally helps Mark's sister like bond and latch onto her baby and like, you know what I mean?
Is that Patricia Arquette?
Yeah, that's Patricia Arquette.
Is that Patricia Arquette's character? Okay.
So it's a very free, and again, she comes off as cultish, scary, freakish, but it's like a super, you know, violation, right? Like this woman is pretending to be somebody else so she can kind of follow her employee in the real world. We eventually find out what she's doing and what it all leads to. Basically, the Innies start revolting. They start, especially when Heliar comes in, she's extremely rebellious. To the point where she actively tries to suicide as she's going up the elevator so that her Audi will experience the death. That's how, like, fucking, you know, upset and pissed off she is at this prison and hell that she has been born into, right? She sees it purely as a human hell, a human-made hell. So she actively, like, when her Audi says, no, you're going to have to stay in there, I order you to keep working. She's like, well, fuck you, bitch. I'm going to kill you. I don't care if it kills me, too. Literally. It's actually pretty, like, baller in a way. I want to kill you by killing myself. And like, that's a new take in movies, usually. Maybe Fight Club has something kind of like that at the end. But anyways. But anyways, so they start finding out a little more. Not really too much, but, like, finding out kind of allying with other people, and they eventually all have reasons to rebel. Dylan in particular, who's the guy who likes the little perks and stuff the most and who seems to enjoy the actual job the most, he eventually turns out they have a switch where they can turn their innies on in the outside world. Like, supposedly we've been told that they only worked at the switch only happened in that severance floor, but they secretly had an ability to turn them on in the outside world. Anywhere, so they can be, you know, their normal innie cells, but on the outside. So Dylan has that for a brief moment with Mr. Milkshake, and he finds out he has a son in like this 2-minute thing. It's actually a very funny scene where Mr. Milkshake tells the son to count to 1,000 and like play hide and seek and not come into the closet for a few minutes. And then obviously it's like a 4-year-old kid, so like, you know, like 500 in, he gets bored and just runs into the closet and says, daddy, daddy, hugging his daddy. You know, he just wants attention and love, isn't really thinking about all this stuff. And Mr. Milkshake actually says, you know, we had an agreement that you were going to count to 1,000 and that you weren't going to come in this room. You broke that agreement. Like, he's talking about a corporate employee. Like, he's so used to
at his, you know, yeah, in his house, like, they're not even in the building
around,
no more.
Just bossing people around, seeing people as just corporate drones that he can't help but be upset that this little kid did flawlessly follow his ridiculous orders. So, so it's a very funny scene, actually. Wait, so Dylan gets pissed off, Irving gets pissed off because John Turturro, because Christopher Walken's leaving. So they actually abuse the system, the same system that let Dylan go and experience seeing his son and stuff. They abuse that system to go outside and kind of tell the world and experience the world only for like 30 minutes, right? It can't last too long. Mr. Milkshake eventually takes down Dylan while he's doing it. But they break into the security room.
It's almost like those lunch breaks at work that like they time you on. If you're late just 1 minute over, that's your ass. So
yeah, it has a very heist movie vibe, actually, where they all plan it out perfectly. It's this whole thing, very high stakes. So at this point, we find out, Mark S., the innie, kind of tells his sister who he is, what's going on, what all the problems are. And we find out Heliar, like the first, you know, Brit lower, the first girl we opened on. Okay, turns out big twist of the, one of the two big twists of the finale. She is Helena Egan. She is the daughter like she's the next in line of the Egan throne, basically. So she's part of the family that started this whole mess, that owns the company. She's the bad guy, basically. That's why she hasn't let
her, she's like amongst them.
Yeah, that's why she hasn't let her innie. She's literally in charge of all the innies in a way.
Yeah, so
right, that's why she finds out Hilly finds out she's basically It's like she. It's not like finding out like Darth Vader is your dad. It's like finding out you are Darth Vader. You know what I mean?
It's right. She was pulling the strings.
It's some Fight Club type shit where it's like, oh my god, I am the bad guy, right? It's
or like, oh, and I am Tyler Durden, and I made him up too. It's like both.
Yeah, it's that kind of a trippy mindset, and so that's one of the big twists. And she basically is in a nice corporate gala where. Basically, she got severed to prove that being severed is safe and cool and no big deal. She was willing to do that basically as like an advertisement for her company, right? And technically, it's safe. So she, but obviously, her and he tried to kill her, so it's not that safe,
right?
And then she goes up on stage, supposed to be giving a speech praising the severance procedure, but she does the opposite. Says they're torturing that she's the innie. That it's all wrong, that it's all evil, that they need to stop. And then the other big twist right at the same time that's happening, the other big twist, because again, Irving, John Turturro, we actually find out is investigating and has a list of other severed employees and is a military guy. So see, he seems to be going in there to try to investigate Lumen and what the fuck they're doing.
Oh, John Turturro's Audi is someone trying to like take Severance down.
It seems like it. He's a military dude. Okay. He has investigations on other severed employees that he probably shouldn't have. Like he's clearly up to some stuff, right?
Right.
And then
great actor.
Great actor. And then Mark S. While he's there with his sister and stuff, they revealed that Mrs. Selvig, the person who's been helping his neighbor and stuff, is Miss Cobell. And that, you know, she shouldn't be there. It's like a big violation. She actually gets fired over this.
Yeah.
Miss Cobell, even though she's like cultishly devoted to the company in an extreme way. And then.
And that was Mark's weird next door neighbor, right?
Yes. And also his boss down there. And then thing. Okay, so you remember when I told you about the wellness center? Like briefly mentioned the wellness center?
Yes.
So there's this lady there. Yes. I can't remember her name. She hasn't been in too many shows. Really striking Asian lady. But like barely has a personality. Is apparently only a part-time innie. Doesn't seem to be a real like barely like functions, but she's just kind of there. They call her Miss Casey. Mm-hmm. But she's an innie. She's the only one with an innie with a last name. But she's not like a proper full-time innie. She actually at one point tells them that she's only experienced 100 hours of life, right? Like 100 hours of work. So she's like literally less than a week of life, literally. And all of the
I gotta just say that it's a horror show in the fact that, like, you know, when you get in the elevator, you don't even, it's like when you go to sleep and just wake up, or like you get put down for like a procedure and you just wake up,
they don't get anything.
It's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's that's very trippy. And again, the people within the universe of the show experience it as such. There's a lot of protests. Mark's own family kind of calls them out. It's not the kind of thing that's looked on favorably by most people, right? Oh, actually forgot one thing. So the guy who got fired at the first day, Peter, Mark, he actually runs into Mark on the outside. It turns out he got reintegrated. There's a procedure for reversing the severance procedure, but they don't really go into it too much. He apparently did the recovery wrong, so he gets like a stroke and dies. Right? He tells Mark basically.
Oh, Peter. Okay, I remember. I remember now.
If you watch the first few episodes, you probably remember him.
Mark,
and so he Mark finds out like how he got, like who unsevered him, who reintegrated him. And so that's another plot line in that it is possible to reintegrate, and that Peter died. Mark kind of met his daughter and such. But anyways, so going back to the end. So Miss Casey, it turns out Mark sees at the last minute of the show, he picks up a picture of him and his wife. Turns out Miss Casey is Gemma, Mark's supposedly dead wife. The whole reason Mark got severed in the first place. And as a bonus, we find out that the university where Mark and his wife used to teach before all that happened.
They're teachers. Yeah.
Is the site where the first severance procedure was invented. And the doctor who reintegrated Petey reintegrated them at that university. That's where her lab is. So obviously,
That
Lumen did some wild stuff.
Okay.
Right? That Lumen
played
a role in Gemma's death. And it's clear the whole time that Mark S is special, even within Lumen, that they consider him like that he did like some special stuff with the numbers that they need done that made him more successful. So they view him as more important. And yeah, that's the end of season one. Now, I'm going to go.
Okay, well, you've convinced. Yeah, I'm convinced.
No, it's amazing, man. It's amazing. Now, I want to go into a quick recap of the first two episodes of season two, where we are. We've already kind of gone over a lot of the themes I was actually going to discuss, but we'll talk about that a little bit and what I like about the first two episodes. And then we'll go into theories for the rest of the season and where I think things are going. So episode one and two are actually intertwined. Episode one deals.
Was it a two-parter?
It wasn't a premiere. But it feel like it should have been. Right. I honestly feel like it would have been better if it was. Episode one is basically based entirely on the Innies' lives within like the aftermath of what happened, right? Basically, we open with Mark S running in, like he's still literally trying to yell, she's alive, trying to tell his outside family that Gemma is alive, that he knows his wife is alive. Right, and then
it picks up like right where season one ended.
Yeah, like the second. At least for him, at least for the innie, right? Because the innie, once he got turned off, the next moment of existence he would experience would be when he came down the elevator. Does that make sense?
So do you think they turned him off when he found the picture? Is that what you're trying to say?
They did. Oh, like remember he had a. They were doing that switch to turn him on the outside. So they turned that off after like the 30-minute allotment that they managed to get away with. And then so again, the next time he's waking up, he's just waking up in the office, right? He doesn't know what's happened.
Do they know that he knows?
Yeah.
The picture?
Yeah, he knows.
No, but do they know he knows?
They're not sure. I don't think they're sure, but they know he was there. They know he was at his house.
Ooh,
okay. Right? Miss Selvig / Cobell was there, right? So that's how they found out that the innies were doing this. So basically he comes in, he gets told by Mr. Milkshake that you know there's been big reforms that the Audi, like their trip outside was basically a big success, that Lumen is taking their needs seriously, that there's going to be big reforms. He shows them this newspaper with like their picture in it to, you know, prove that like changes are being made. Of course, if you're sharp-eyed and pause the screen, you'll notice it's a clearly photoshopped image from season one on top of an old presidential car. It's like called the Keir newspaper. It's very obvious it's a lie. He tells Mark it's been 5 months. We again don't know if that's true or not. There's some signs that there's not, because like Mr. Milchick is now in charge of the severed floor. Miss Cobell got fired, and he is basically, his office is still saying, welcome, Miss Cobell. Like there's signs that it hasn't really been anywhere near as long as he's telling Marquez. But we don't know. We don't know if it's the next day. We don't know if it's a month. Mr. Milchick tells us it was 5 months. It's clearly not 5 months. So anyway, Mark goes on.
Wait, does Mark believe Mr. Milkshake?
It's kind of unknown. He seems to, but not really. Right? But he at least acts like he does.
Okay.
When he gets to his office, he sees three brand new people.
Mm-hmm.
Most famous of which is Alia Shaquat.
Maybe Funke. Maybe Funke.
Yes. Yes. So she is the most famous one we see. When we see two other people, including like one Italian guy who literally doesn't speak English. He just speaks Italian the whole time. It's kind of funny. Like a foreign exchange worker. So you have three new people, and Mark is told that the other workers didn't want to come in, that he was the only one that had wanted to, like, begged to come back in, and that's why he was here, right? But it seems to be heavily implied at this point that they really want Mark, that the other people, you know, it's nice to have, but they really need Mark specifically.
It is collateral. Right? Okay.
Yeah. And then, the other people, like, they need four people, but they want Mark specifically.
It's Mark special.
Mark, we also get introduced. So in season one, Miss Cobell was the leader, and then Mr. Milchick was like her second in command.
Mm-hmm.
So now Mr. Milchick is the leader, and his second in command is a little girl, like a 10-year-old girl named Miss Huang. Okay. And we don't know anything about her. The only thing she says is that she's a crossing guard. When somebody asks her why she's a child, her response is, because of the day I was born, like, as a joke, right? She like kind of like watches over them and leads them in team building exercises and stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, she behaves kind of robotic a lot of the time. Only time we see her actually being a kid at one point, when Mr. Milchick closes his office, she kind of plays with this little weird, you know, those little bubble like water games you play with as a kid in your hand, where you like spit bubbles to make things blow into little pins and stuff. Yeah, that kind of stuff. So it's like her only childlike moment of the whole show.
That's kind of, and that's actually kind of upsetting, because again, you know, we live in a world post child labor law. So again, this corporation has no qualms about, you know, putting young children.
Well, that's one of the things. It's at least possible from her position that she's like some important person's family member or something else is going on, because again, she's in charge of this place,
right?
In a way that does not seem like a lost little kid. She's an interesting character to watch. Yeah. Lots of theories abound about what's going on with her. One of the most curious characters. She also says at one point that she was a crossing guard before coming in here, which some people on the internet have taken as a sign kind of, hey, it's a crossing guard, so maybe that has something to do with the car accident.
Perhaps.
Mark's wife.
Perhaps.
That might be a stretch, but I do think the crossing guard part is going to be relevant going forward.
Right.
Anyways, Mark instantly rebels and gets pissed off and manages to actually talk to the board of the company, at least get a message out to them. Says, no, I'm not coming back. I'm not doing work. I'm not doing anything unless you bring me my old team. At which point, the next day when he comes in, which we have a weird transition. Usually we see a smooth elevator transition in and out of the building between when they go into an Audi and an Indy. We have this kind of like, it's a split second dark frame that looks like a scary dark frame scene from season one where they were taking Miss Casey when she wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
So again, kind of an implication there, maybe something kind of weird happened there. And then the next day he comes in and he's with his four employees. They are also reacting just like they're coming off the second where we last saw them on TV, like when they were out doing stuff in the world.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I forgot to mention at the end is that Helly and Mark kind of became a little bit of a thing. They kissed at the end of season one.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the beginning of season two, Helly is immediately a lot more cautious, a lot more withdrawn, doesn't really hug Mark, and just seems like rattled.
She got too deep.
Probably because of what she saw.
Yeah, she caught feelings.
What she saw outside. Although we don't know. We don't exactly know. We haven't seen. We haven't seen what happened between the last time, which is possible she's been, you know, we don't know.
Right.
So anyways, Mr. Milkshake basically kind of the same way he showed Mark as that they made changes. He shows them this video of the Lumen building and Keir. Again, Keir, the Jesus-like figure flying overhead.
Mm.
And just all the reforms are supposedly making, all the big changes. Like apparently the break room is now gone. It's not going to be a torture room anymore.
Yeah,
wellness room is also gone. So no more Miss Casey, right? Mark notices right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like all these things are being changed. More perks, more less cameras everywhere, all these things.
Okay. And then,
we basically kind of see the character's readjustment. Helly still seems suspicious. She does not tell them that she was Helena Egan. She tells them some lie about how she woke up in her apartment, didn't get to talk to anybody. She tells them she saw a night gardener, which Irving suspects is a lie, you can tell. You also see her flirting. You also see her flirting with Mark when she finds out he has a wife and he's trying to look for her inside the building, right? Like find out what happened to Miss Casey / Gemma.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see little pangs of jealousy and anger at her Audi. So again, it's a little bit of a mystery exactly what's going on there. So that's pretty much the end. And then again, we're seeing Mr. Milchick try to like get into place in his new office and stuff. And Danny's kind of getting back to work. And that's pretty much where the episode goes. And then episode two is the mirror episode where we see everything that happened on the outside while these events were occurring.
Right? That's cool.
So obviously, it's a major fallout. Lumen happens to get ahead of Helly R's big fuck up. Telling everybody that severed people are tortured. Basically, they say that, you know, she had too much alcohol and a non-lumen medication, right? I had to get the good advertising out there.
Make sure.
Yeah, non-lumen medication, yeah. They make very sure. They get rid of all the actual video. They managed to secure all the tapes.
Grubber.
So basically, they kind of do a PR blitz to kind of tamp it down. And then they go to each of the Audis who escaped. The two, Irving and Dylan, they're both fired, right? They're just both fired on the spot for fucking up. And then Helena, Egan obviously has no interest in going back down there.
Right.
So that's why we have three new workers at the beginning of the first episode, right? That's where that's established. We actually see some of them walking in at one point into the office. So Helena's trying to like piece together, come up with a plan. And then so they start investigating Mark to find out how much he knew, what he said to his family, all this stuff. Mr. Milkshake goes to Mark's house. He's the only one they don't fire. They desperately try to win him over, tell him to come back. At one point, Mr. Milchick actually tells them openly, he's like, hey, what your Audi did was very bad and very stupid, but also very brave. So don't quit and punish your Audi with non-existence. Like literally telling him, he's like, hey, you're killing this guy inside if you do this.
Oh, okay. He's trying to play to that. Okay, but he's a company guy, Mr. Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Milchick, but it's still a wild thing to hear.
It is, very much so. Okay.
Yeah, it's like getting deep into the philosophical, and he just says it so, like as a way to persuade him. So Mark's not really convinced. They actually don't know. They heard Mark S. say she's alive, but they don't know if he was talking about his wife. He was holding his wife's picture, so his sister kind of thinks he was talking about his wife.
Mm-hmm.
But her sister's husband thinks he was just talking about the baby or something else, right? That doesn't, just kind of in denial a little bit. But the sister's suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also start, like, you know, you can see like some security guy from Newman investigating, trying to hear them out. And Mr. Milchick keeps trying to like convince him to come back. And then at some point, you know, I think Mark does to kind of investigate and find out what's happening and just out of curiosity and all that, he decides to come back, right?
Right.
At that point, you know, next thing you know, we don't see him go in, obviously. You see him go in the elevator and just come immediately back out. It's the experience of the outside. And then we see a little bit of Dylan in particular gets in a bad spot. He seems to have really needed the Lumen job. But that's what he was doing. He just needed the money. And that's why he was willing to get severed. Doesn't have any, like, superior reasons to that. So you see him trying to get another job. We see people who'd be prejudiced against him and hateful to him because he was a severed employee. And he's like scared. He doesn't know what he's going to do with his wife. He's stressed out. And then suddenly they're all offered their jobs back, right? Well, you know, obviously it's because Mark forced them to, but they don't know that. They just, you know, Mr. Milchick just comes back and just offers them all their jobs.
Oh, so Mr. Milchick just comes in and just tells them, hey, it's all good now. You guys can just come back and work for us now.
Yeah, basically offers them their jobs again. Oh. They keep a nice little like fruit basket with a pineapple to all of them. It's pretty funny. So they all decide to come back. Even Helena just goes back in as her innie. She doesn't do any like weird tricks. She just goes back in. Right. Oh. So I think we don't quite see. We're not 100% sure. It could be a twist later on, but it's meant to imply that, you know, the first time we see Helly down there is the first time
she's been
out. And that the reason she didn't tell anybody what's going on is because she's embarrassed or frightened or just doesn't want to admit.
Yeah, she's in on
that.
She's
an Egan. She's the reason.
Yeah, that's a big deal. It's a big deal to reveal.
Yeah. So, that's pretty much where we are. We just see a little more scenes. We see like the last bit of Miss Selvig before she drives away in her car. She runs into Mark and kind of laughs at him for not quitting because she's quitting. They kind of offer her job back too, but then she decides not to take it. Or it's a similar job, not the same job. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, that's kind of where we are, where, you know, they're obviously both Marks are trying to investigate kind of what happened. Everybody's gone back to the severed world, the severed, you know, we've reestablished kind of the status quo from season one a little bit. Although obviously the characters aren't going to be happy to just sit there and take it.
Yeah.
And then the one big hint about what's going on in the season. Okay, so I've talked a little bit about their like work with the numbers.
Mm.
So when they're doing their work, the way they describe it is that the numbers there's just a big field of numbers on the screen, and certain like numbers, like close to, in groups together, give the worker sensations. Like, these numbers feel scary. These numbers feel happy. These numbers feel surprising. Right? There's like a couple different things. And so they group them up when they feel that the numbers mean something, and they put them in these little boxes. So at the end, when Mark's innie is going back to work and he's looking at his screen, we, you know, he see him focus on the screen, and then we have a split screen where we see a, like a kind of sci-fi looking bio screen for Mark's wife, where we see some of the same numbers and some of the same things he's filling in at his computer screen are the ones that are going into her file, right? Her bio screen, right?
Right, right.
It's meant to be a strong implication that whatever Mark is doing, it has something to do with the wife, and that the fact that, you know, almost like maybe he's recreating her memories, or creating a personality,
or put her in a body or something.
To life. But he's not doing that. Lumen is having him do that.
Yeah.
Right. Lumen actually has several experiments in season one where they put him and his wife together to make sure they don't really remember each other, that they're any selves and all that. So again, it lends a air of mystery.
Yeah. So why Lumen so invested?
Going into some of the other mysteries and things, we big reveal in season one, not really a reveal, but big hint was that Petey had drawn a map of Lumen, like the inside of Lumen after he'd gotten reintegrated. And one of the big like rooms inside the building was a room that Petey had labeled Mind, right? Like, you know, the brain.
Right.
And again, it goes to what we're looking at with the kind of the building, like maybe, I don't know, they're putting some memories into the building. We don't really know. Nobody really knows what's going on. One of the other departments is just making like these flashcards and these weird, they're called the optical department. So they're just making visual stuff. It's the kind of stuff that doesn't really make sense to anything. One department is raising baby goats. Like one kind of secretive department we see raising baby goats at one point. It's not really meant to make any sense so far. Actually, one of my potential theories is that something about the chip or something about the floor, like some of the visuals they see, the severed innie see, are not what an actual person would see in the same scenario. Does that make sense?
They're able to control what you see as a...
I'm not 100% sure. Like, there's nothing that's quite implied that.
Right.
Maybe reading too much into it. No, but just the fact that, you know, they see these random numbers and randomly scroll around them and they get a sensation. Or that, oh, these numbers feel scary. Like, this seems odd. You know what I mean? And they're telling them, like, oh, you have a special intuition that allows you to see these numbers. And Mark, in particular, is supposed to be, like, the best at this particular intuition that allows him to see these numbers. So again, you have the hints of, okay, so maybe they killed him or killed his wife to kind of try to get him to work
for them. So
they could study him because they, you know, they thought something special about him. Maybe something about the fact that his dead wife, like his feelings for his dead wife, make it easier for him to see the numbers, right? There's these kinds of implications that there's something shady and mysterious going on there. From the cult-like behavior of the Egans as well, especially their cult-like admiration, not just of whoever's in charge, but the original Keir, right? It's not just all the Egans, it's Keir especially.
Mm-hmm.
There's maybe a hint that they're trying to recreate or rebirth him, that they're trying to make him immortal in some sense. There's obviously also we don't know what Lumen really does. We kind of find out there's some kind of biotech company, but we don't entirely find out how they've become so powerful and big and strong.
Just more mystery as to as to what they're doing. Yeah,
there's some implication that, you know, I mentioned it earlier, that the severance chips, like the rich senator's wife that got severed just for her own convenience and stuff. Again, what else could it be? Like, could they sever somebody and turn him into an assassin? Could they sever someone and do corporate espionage? You know what I mean? They haven't gone that far into severed people on the outside and what that means. So there's just a lot of mysteries left. I think it's a tremendous show. the acting performances, the themes, again, the strong themes of this kind of corporate hellhole that's presented in such a nice way. Tremendous show. Highly recommend it. My favorite show going right now, 10 out of 10. Really, my only criticism is that the first two episodes, I feel like, should have been released together. Some people went hardcore with the conspiracies and the theories after episode one, and a decent amount of them were pretty much immediately disproven in episode two.
Yeah, like a lot of, yeah, as a I think, yeah, as a viewer, it's you should never make your speculation about some of your expectation, because you then would ruin the show. You didn't write the show. Yeah, it's cool to speculate, it's cool to have like cool theories, but once the show begins, you should be able to leave all that at the door and enjoy the show for what it is, and then judge it based on that merit. But yeah. But you know, it happens with fandom a lot. It's what it is.
For sure. No, I agree. But it's the kind of show that encourages that, though. I will say it is the kind of show that encourages heavy speculation, heavy thinking about what its themes mean, and. You know, it's the kind of show where you try to picture yourself, oh, would I sever myself?
Yeah, what would I do?
Right?
Yeah.
What would the world look like if I was in it? It's the kind of thing where, oh, that seems kind of cool sometimes, right? Like, we've all had times where it's like, oh, you mean I can just go to work and, you know, I just, next thing you know, I'm just home? That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Right? And that doesn't sound that bad.
Yeah.
You know, from the Audi's perspective. So, again, it just makes you, it's the kind of show that makes you think, makes you play into those themes. Wonderful show.
Wonderful cast. I'm definitely convinced.
Really excited to see. Go watch it, man.
Yeah.
It's the best show on television. No. And only real downside is that it's been three seasons since season one. And hopefully, they're already filming season three. Hopefully, it's closer. I can't see them going more than four seasons. Frankly, it's the kind of story that benefits from being wrapped up. You know, in a fairly brisk fashion,
right. And it sounds like they're headed towards like where they want to go. And knowing Ben Stiller and Erickson, the showrunner, like I know they have, you know, a definite plan. Like I know Ben Stiller, you know, he read this whole screenplay like, you know, 5 years ago, and to see where it is now, where it's like the biggest show on Apple TV, a show that I need to now go sit down and watch, because yeah, it's the biggest show. In going right now, and I do not want to be left out of just any of the discussion about this. But Juan, this is, you really, really laid it out, and not just for me, but also for like the viewers, like as to like what this show is, what to expect. And yeah, I'm definitely excited for this season two, even though I got to finish watching season one now. I have to go back and finish all that. But no, this sounds awesome, man. Yeah. Thank you.
So yeah, quick little apology to the viewers. We were hoping to get a quick episode out, but I think Kosei got really excited discussing the themes and ideas behind the show. I think we both did. Yeah. Good discussion overall, brother. Hopefully the Mooney's Mini Bites going forward will actually be a mini episode. But hopefully you all enjoyed this first try at it.
Yeah, man. Yes, sir. And yeah, and once again, it's me, Kosei, and I'm joined always by Wannabe. And I just want to thank you all for showing into this this Mooney Mini Bites episode. So, till next time, guys. Peace out.
Adios.